Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode.
Welcome back to the podcast. This week, Barry is in Calgary, where he is meeting clients. Baskin Wealth has clients all over Canada. And if you are interested in our services and you like the podcast and you want to meet one of us, we very likely will be in one of your cities from time to time. So please reach out and give us a call. And as usual, if you like this podcast, please give us a 5-star review or a like. Today, since Barry is in Calgary, I am very happy to be joined by our head of financial planning, Benjamin Klein. He is our in-house financial planner. And one of the things about financial planning that I think is a little bit unique is that on this podcast, we're often talking about stocks and should you buy Apple or Google or Domino's Pizza? But that's only one aspect of portfolio management and what we're doing here at Baskin. I think the other part, and probably the more important part of wealth management, is the financial planning, the wealth, the actual wealth aspect. Because in many cases, our clients are entrusting all of their assets of their family to us. And so there's questions about, like, how should I plan for the future? What kinds of objectives are they looking to do with that money? Are they able to suffer through large losses such as a tariff or a COVID type event? And so Ben is here and very capable to answer these questions. I'm glad to have you.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be back.
So what is financial planning, first of all, and why do we need it?
So I get this question a lot. It's kind of a nebulous concept, in part because I don't think the name really tells you very much about it. And also in part because it really covers several different, almost independent areas of planning. So there's planning. I think most people would consider it, do I have enough money to retire or to do some other project, buy a house, pay for my kids' education, whatever your major objective is. But there's also, you know, a handful of other, sometimes independent, sometimes dependent variables that you can also talk about when you're talking about financial planning. It can be insurance coverage. Do I have enough? Do I have too much? Do I need any? It can be things like managing your tax situation, your estate situation. There are really a handful of different, you know, planning components that can all go into a financial plan, which some of which can affect every person, some of which will only affect some people. But the bottom line is just trying to take a holistic view of everything that goes into a person's finances and you know, making an assessment of what changes, if any, are necessary.
And so as a financial planner, let's say somebody comes to you and says, I want a financial plan. How does that process typically look like?
Sure. Good question. So the first question I always ask when someone says, I want to explore financial planning or do a financial plan or whatever they say, I say, what is the question that you want to have answered? And in some cases, it can be, well, I'm 65 and I'm retiring in a couple of years. Do I have enough money to retire? And I want to look at, you know, different scenarios. If I make more money on my investments, if I like less money, if I spend more, spend less, what have you. But sometimes it's much more specific. So I met with a client this morning who's thinking of retiring from their government job. We talked through different possibilities of what they could do with their pension. I've had people talk about, well, I have this much insurance coverage. I'm being offered, you know, a chance to renew my coverage with these parameters. And so, you know, sometimes it involves what I think people probably think of when they think of a financial plan, which is, you know, a 20-page PDF with a lot of different charts and a lot of numbers, probably not the most thrilling document you've ever looked at in your life. And sometimes that's, you know, sometimes that's relevant, particularly when you want to look at different scenarios over time, when you want to track changes over time. But it can really mean a lot of different things. And I think one of the things that I find interesting about financial planning is, number one, the problem-solving aspect, because right. you are talking about different things that interconnect, and that it's relatively broad. I'm the kind of guy who has a lot of different interests. And I like the idea that you're not just coming from just from an investment perspective or even just an insurance perspective or something else. You're looking at everything and seeing how they interconnect.
Now, how much of the types of financial planning and the advice that ends up coming from this process is what you would call just common sense, like spend less, mm-hmm. Save more, and those kinds of things?
Some, but not, I would not say a majority. I do say to a lot of my clients, well, you know, there's an easy solution to this, which is work until you die.
Right.
Make twice as much as you're making now. And to a significant extent, financial planning at some point becomes maybe less relevant.
Right.
You know, if you have $10 million and you spend $40,000 a year, you don't need a plan. You know, the plan is keep doing what you're doing and you're never going to run out of money. But even in that case, and this is a situation that, I mean, happily we've had with a lot of our clients who do have enough money or maybe even more money than they expect, that's not the end of the story. Maybe it's, well, how much money do you want to leave to your kids? Maybe you want to make a major charitable donation. Maybe you want to, you know, support your nieces or nephews or some other plan that you want to do that maybe you didn't know that you could do in the first place. So the very basic stuff, absolutely. Sometimes that, you know, it's as simple as keep doing what you're doing or make more money,
right?
or something along those lines. But there's always something else that can be explored at the same time.
But I also think that there is an element where you're providing a little bit more data specifically around what a person can do. So like, for example, in the scenario with that has a large amount of savings and they're spending very little, maybe they didn't know that they were allowed to spend more money.
Yep, absolutely. A big part of it is it's almost like an educational experience. Clients who, I see this a lot, both on, you know, so I'm also a portfolio manager in addition to the, you know, the head of financial planning, with a handful of my clients who, particularly the ones that have worked and, you know, either they grew up without a lot of money or whatever the situation is, they have, you know, they made their money through working. They have found it really hard to flip the switch from working and, you know, spending out of what's coming in every month to living off their nest egg, essentially. And so there's a lot of the data, as you allude to, helps you make that case. Well, if returns are 5% or whatever number you want to choose, and if you live this long, you can spend this, and we have lots of fancy Monte Carlo analysis and different statistical analysis that we can use. But it can say more than, well, you're probably fine if you spend $20,000 a year more. But we can say, well, 95% of the time, you know, if returns are reasonable, you can do this and you can do that. When it's not necessarily, there's a degree to which it becomes more data driven and less common sense.
No, I think I think I want to talk a little bit about that point that you just made about it being kind of dependent on returns, right? So I think one of the benefits of a firm like Baskin Wealth, where you have both the financial plan as well as the portfolio management, is that you can take the results of the plan and actually implement it on a portfolio level for the needs of the client. Mm-hmm. So how much of the advice that results from the financial plan actually depends, like how much of the asset allocation or the portfolio management decisions actually result from these types of things?
So I'll say, happily for the most part, when I look at a client's portfolio, if they're with us, and I should say all of our clients are with us, right? This is a service that we offer really exclusively to clients of the firm. I don't do fee for service planning for non-clients. The vast majority of the time, the asset allocation is appropriate because we know our clients, we know how they think, we know what they would think is a reasonable asset allocation. But I have seen situations where looking at the portfolio and taking, again, a more holistic view kind of opens up options. For example, I had a client who I would say maybe from 10,000 foot, you probably didn't really need a financial plan in the sense that she has enough money.
Right.
It's not something that comes naturally to her, kind of understanding the numbers, understanding the financial aspect of the portfolio. And by looking together, we were able to discuss actually taking less risk.
Right.
She felt that she needed to take more risk because she needed to grow the portfolio over time. And showing that, well, even if returns are 3%, 4%, 5%, you know, you're really in no danger of running out of money. And if it would bring you more comfort and less anxiety of having a more conservatively managed portfolio, that was a way to demonstrate that. So I mean, I think for your average investor, probably a lot. For our investors, happily not that often.
And I think that's one of the challenges over the last, say, 15 or 16 years, basically since the financial crisis, where bonds have, apart from a short blip in 2022, haven't really paid very much income at all, especially for more conservative type investors who are requiring the income from their portfolio to live on. So do you think that this kind of current environment for fixed income, like how does that change the financial planning and how does that change the asset allocations going forward?
To some degree, I actually think it almost makes it simpler because, you know, even nowadays with inflation, you're probably still looking at, you know, real returns on, at least in Canada, on bonds of maybe 1.5%, probably right. Not even that much. And so I say to my clients, you know, no one's getting rich on bonds. It's been a long time since anyone got rich on bonds. And even when they did, a lot of it had to do with trading as opposed to just buy and hold bond investing. I say, you know, the analogy I like to use, it's like shock absorbers on a car. You know, you could build a car with no shock absorbers.
Yeah.
It would be lighter, probably go faster.
Yeah.
But you know, when you hit a bump in the road or a bumpy patch, it's going to be really bumpy, and that's just the nature of the thing. You still might get there faster, but you know, if you hit a really bumpy part or you hit a pothole, you're probably going to wish you had put the shock absorbers on. But it's not going to get you there faster. If anything, it's probably going to slow you down. So really, it's a trade-off between, and this is again kind of comes into looking at the data and looking at the person's financials. Do you need to make 10% a year to retire? Do you need to make 8, 9, 10% a year to retire? And if you're okay with 5% or 6%, then you have that option. And you know, the financial plan doesn't necessarily have to change your behavior, but it lets you know that you have the option to take a more conservative path.
Right.
And particularly if you're the kind of person who does get anxious when the market is volatile, and by volatile, of course, I mean down, then you have that option, and that can, you know, that can lead to a lot of better sleep and less stress.
Right. And I think especially given the fact that returns for, especially in US, like the NASDAQ has basically tripled in the last 10 years or something like that, mm-hmm. where I think return expectations for equities today are kind of as high as I've ever seen them.
Yeah.
So do you find that there's a need to kind of properly calibrate expectations for people?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this applies both to financial planning and portfolio management. I mean, in the last 10 years, we had 2022, which was lousy. We had basically 2 months of 2020, which was horrible, but then the year ended up being just fine. 2018 was, you know, slightly negative, and 2015, I guess, is actually more than 10 years ago now, but that was also a pretty crummy year. We've really only had 3 significant downturns in the last decade, one of which was basically over almost before you knew it. And almost all the years that weren't down have been unbelievable. So, you know, I've said, and it actually kind of worries me a little bit as an investor, that expectations are so high.
If I double my portfolio every year, then I don't need a financial plan.
Exactly. Right? And it's true. If you're a brilliant investor and you take a lot of risk and you get it right.
Right.
Absolutely. That's one of the potential outcomes. But you know, I've said to a lot of clients, the last 10 years have been great. The last 15 years have been great. But number one, long-term listeners, of course, know we don't try to time the market, but we're coming up. We're basically 4 or 5 months away from 4 consecutive years of the market going up, almost in a straight line. And so that, maybe that means that the market's only ever going to go up for the rest of human history. I think that's pretty unlikely. But I think more likely it means that, you know, maybe your next 3 to 5 to 10 year expectations would probably be a little bit more tempered.
But how does all this stuff flow through back into the financial plan?
I think to a significant part, I always say to clients, look, if we're the point of financial planning to me is not to say, you know, you're 55 years old and we're trying to project to within the penny how right. much money you're going to have when you're 100.
Right.
The point is, and you know, back to analogies, I say it's like Goldilocks, you know, trying the porridge.
Yeah.
The question is, on your current trajectory, is it too cold? Is it too hot? You know, maybe you have way more money. You should invest more conservatively, yeah. or you can retire early or whatever. Or is it just right? And then you compare over time, you compare the trend line to what the expectations were. So when I'm putting together assumptions, you know, putting together the plan is really just a, you know, kind of a fancy calculator, and you put the numbers in and it, you know, runs and it calculates them for you. I always prefer to at least start on the more conservative side. I usually say we're going to make 6% per year. You know, we've made a lot more than that happily historically. Will we do better than that in the future? I have no idea. And then if we want to look at more aggressive scenarios, great. And we can see right. how they compare. But I always say, you know, whether I've been saying that, so, you know, 3 years ago when we didn't just have the last 3 years we had, which were all very strong. I think it really helps you to understand what reasonable expectations are and how you need to adjust your priors for that.
So one of the things that it has always seemed to me in terms of discussing about financial planning within the context of our firm is that it's almost always about, like, do I have enough money to retire? Partly that's reflective of the client base that we have. But what about for people who are not close to retirement? Let's say they are kind of, they own a house, they're married, they have children, and they are 20 years away from retirement. Or even the 25-year-old who is single, he's kind of early in his career and he's looking to buy a place.
Yeah.
So how does the financial planning differ for these types of scenarios?
So it's interesting. You know, those other, the most classic quote unquote example is, you know, you're in your say 40s or 50s and you're approaching retirement. I think one of the reasons for that is because it's more projectable.
Right.
The closer you are, the better the sense of your financials, the better a sense of what's already happened, and there are fewer unknowns. It's almost more important for those younger people to have a financial plan because there's more time for them to correct if they need to. But at the same time, say you're 25.
Yeah.
You might get married. You might buy a house. You might be working in a completely different career. Your job might not exist 5 years from now.
Right.
I mean, there's an infinite number of possibilities. And, you know, I think we all know the further out you project something, the more inaccurate it becomes just by its nature. I think everybody deserves to have a really needs to, not just deserves, to have a peek at what's going on. You know, if you're 35 and you're working in a reasonably good job and, you know, things are working out okay, you're saving a little bit of money, maybe you're putting money in your RSPs and TFSAs, then great. I don't know how much value there is into really, really diving really deep
right.
and trying to save $50, you know, on this and that every year, even if that does add up
right.
you know, financially to something significant over time. Just because there are so many unknowns. You know, you could be moving houses, you could, you know, move in countries, you could be moving jobs. So I think, you know, everybody should have a sense of where they are, what their current trajectory is, but not necessarily. I think when you're, you know, say you're 55, you know, this can really be your retirement Bible.
Right.
I mean, you're going to have to, you're still making assumptions, of course, and you could be making assumptions 40 years out, but it can really help illustrate what your path to retirement looks like and should look like. Whereas when you're much younger, it's much more of a, you know, as opposed to a vector, it's a scalar. It's a how are you right now?
Right.
And you know, less about what's 30 years from now going to look like.
How important is tax considerations in all of this?
It's important, clearly. I think a lot, you know, of course, I'm not an accountant, so I'm not giving clients, you know, really specialized tax advice.
Right.
But you know, there is optimization you can do. I mean, you and I just talked about this offline in terms of, you know, putting certain investments, if they're going to give you interest income or they're going to give you capital gains income, in certain types of accounts to, you know, be more more efficient, making sure that you get RSP contributions, making sure you
yeah.
use them in certain years. You know, I have clients who maybe they're on maternity leave or they switch jobs or something. And then, you know, I say, well, have you thought about pausing yeah. RSP contributions or not deducting them in each year. And sometimes that's something they haven't considered. Or I actually had a client who has been with us for decades now. She's actually quite young, but she's been with us for decades. And she has a significant unrealized capital gain in her portfolio.
Right.
And we talked about, well, why don't we think about doing this when you're on maternity leave? And so we ended up actually triggering a lot of capital gains for her when her income was lower.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of different, you know, scenarios you can run into in terms of tax planning. I think for most people, you know, really it comes down to judicious use of RSPs and TFSAs in the right years, and, you know, making sure your investments are held in the right place. When it comes to things like, you know, corporations and more and trusts and more complex tax structures, you know, my advice and experience is usually, you know, pretty uncommon, frankly. I mean, most people don't need them. They're, you know, they're expensive, and the tax savings are not always that significant at, you know, given the tax changes in Canada over the last couple of decades. Everybody needs, even if the difference is not that huge, you know, say 2% of the value of your portfolio, as making that number up.
Right.
If it doesn't cost you anything, you might as well optimize.
Right. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because I think a lot of people often spend too much time even thinking about the tax optimizations. Mm-hmm. Is interest going to be taxed at a lower rate in my RRSP or my TFSA or in a margin account, when the reality is that if you have a stock and it goes up 30%, you would have wanted that in a tax sheltered account.
Yeah. And the reality is, at the end of the day, you can never avoid tax.
Right.
You know, you obviously, again, you want to optimize it. You want to be as efficient as you can. But like everything else, particularly in financial planning, it's based on assumptions. And, you know, like going back to our previous point, all you need to do is just, you know, only buy stocks that go up 10 times and you never have to worry about anything.
So let's say today, there's an abundance of places that you can put money in Canada. You can put it into your RSP. You can put it into TFSA. If you don't own a home, you have the first home buyer's plan. Mm-hmm. You can pay down mortgage debt.
Yeah.
Right. So what is kind of the hierarchy of how a person should allocate capital today?
Yeah. So, I mean, the number one question is, you know, what's the person's really financial, I wouldn't say financial situation, but financial balance sheet, or not balance sheet, income statement really, right, for the year. I mean, if they make a lot of money, obviously that impacts how important the RSP is.
Right.
They might also have a pension, of course, that affects things. So, I mean, obviously everybody's situation is different. But my personal, you know, there isn't really a rule of thumb here, but if we needed to have a rule of thumb, it would be something like, if you're a reasonably high earner, let's say 150,000 plus per year, your number one priority should be your RSP. It's, I mean, the value of not just the long-term compounding, but the short-term, you know, deduction is really valuable as much as you can. TFSAs are great. I mean, they may not be the absolute best for everybody, you know, particularly if you're a high earner, but, you know, I think of them as almost as good as an RSP, even in the case of a high earner, where an RSP is great. And I mean, basically amazing, right, and everything else too. They're you know, it's really one of the best programs I think Canada's ever done,
yeah,
in terms of savings. It's flexible. It, you know, it's good for short term. It's good for long term. It's good for medium term. You know, you can own investments in it. You can grow it. You can put a GIC in it if you need it. It's really just really flexible and well-designed. For people who have kids that want to pay for their kids' education, really hard to beat the RESP. It's free money, hard to beat free money in my experience, particularly actually, right, if your income is not very low, you can get actually even more quote unquote free money, as long as you're able to make the contributions to the plan. And so what I usually say to my clients is, if paying for your kids' education is a priority, it's not for everybody, and that's fine. Really, you should be contributing, right, first to one of the three,
yeah,
RSP, TFSA, and RESP. In some order, I say for most people, probably RRSP comes first and then TFSA. But really, those three should come first because the tax benefits, and in the case of the RRSP, the grant, are so valuable. After that, it's really hard to assess. You know, if you have a mortgage,
yeah,
can never really go too wrong going paying down your mortgage.
Right.
You can obviously invest in a non-registered account. You might be able to use a first home savings account. First home savings accounts, just to riff on those very quickly, are actually kind of amazing.
Yeah.
If you don't own a home, and if you do own a home, obviously you don't qualify. But just giving you the ability to, it's almost like getting the best of both worlds between the RSP and the TFSA, because obviously if the goal is to buy a house here, you get the deduction from the RSP. There's no risk of getting it stranded in there, because after 15 mm-hmm. years, you can just move it into your RSP. And you get to take it out tax-free when you buy a house, giving you that kind of short-term advantage compared to a TFSA. So they're amazing. If that's a part of your plan, you should really have one.
And you can roll it over to your
and
RSP.
And you roll it over, exactly. So there's no risk of kind of running out. There's no, well, if I don't buy a house in 15 years, you just roll it over to your RSP, and right, there's no tax consequence. So it's really fantastic. After that, I really say to clients, it really comes down to your own psychology. Some people really don't like having debt.
Yeah.
And let's say they might make, you know, 6 or 7% or whatever after tax in their non-registered account, if they invest it, and they might only save, you know, whatever their mortgage is, 4% by paying it down. I think particularly if it's not a huge amount of money, I think to a lot of people that's, you know, there's a significant, we would call it psychic income from paying down your mortgage early. Personally, I mean, this is a little bit unscientific. I usually just split the difference.
Okay.
If I have right. leftover money, I'll put half in a non-registered account. Excuse me, half to the mortgage. It feels about right.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, I've talked about this with a lot of my clients. If you're trying to max out your RSP, max out both, say you're, especially if you're in a couple, max out two RSPs, max out two TFSAs, RESPs for however many kids you have, you can easily be talking about $80,000 a year right off the
right.
bat. And so, I mean, if you have a lot of extra money right. after that, fantastic.
Yeah.
And yes, you do get a deduction for the RSP. But the reality is, I think the vast majority of people do not have a lot of extra money after that. And so, you know, if we're talking about $10,000 of extra cash flow at the end of the year, and you're splitting it between the two, you know, even if you pick the wrong one, we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars here. So I think you should pick what makes you feel the best.
Okay, maybe just on for a last question, AI. Can I just get financial advice and ask ChatGPT to create a financial plan for me?
So I've never tried it. I think the answer is, can you ask it specific questions? Probably yes.
Yes.
You know, the thing about financial planning is it really is a lot of different questions being asked. There's, you know, they're sort of independent, but they are sort of interconnected. And I can say you'll probably get the right answer.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we all know AI is not perfectly accurate and, you know, can mix stuff up. I would say this is probably actually a pretty good thing for AI to be good at because, you know, it's good at, you know, synthesizing answers into the answers that make sense. Are you going to, if you ask it a really specific tax question, is it going to get it right? I don't know.
Right.
If you're asking it about, you know, the benefits of RSPs versus TFSAs, it probably knows the answer to that. I don't know if there are, you know, purely AI generated financial plans in Canada that exist. They might. I wouldn't be surprised if they do. And I have no idea what the quality is if so. But I would say, you know, for specific questions about, you know, different aspects of a plan, I think there's a very good chance it would be just fine. Is it always going to do an amazing job of, you know, looking at a holistic, lots of interconnected variables? I don't know. I hope it doesn't put me out of business, but
and I think part of it is kind of like a personal trainer, right?
Yeah.
Where the plan is only the first part.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is whether you stick to it in the end.
Yeah.
Because like ChatGPT can tell me that I need to lose weight and I need to eat healthier.
Yeah.
Like I had Popeyes for lunch today. But whether you stick to it or not, I think it's a little bit harder when you don't have that layer of accountability.
Yeah, that's probably true. And you know, I think to some extent, I think about, you know, we're both Peloton. Or I know you have a Peloton at home. I'm also a Peloton subscriber. You know, even if it's in your house, you still have to use it.
Right.
And you know, yes, it's easier and that's great. But when it comes down to it, I mean, even if it can, and again, I don't even know if it can put together, you know, a sensible plan for you. It really comes down to the person. It's really your job to make sure that you're watching it change over time. And if you're sticking to the plan and it's doing everything you want to, fantastic. But if it's not, whether it's getting better or getting worse, you need to know if you should be making changes or not.
Great. Well, I thought this was a really great conversation. I think we should do this again at some point because I personally learned a lot too, because I usually think about things from just is this stock going to go up or not? And not really around a holistic perspective. So I hope you enjoyed that, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.